This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I don't know whether corporate purgatory is exactly the right analogy here, but today Lehman Brothers found itself a place somewhere between failure and government bailout. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, working to redefine healthcare and the patient experience with the new Miller Family Pavilion and Glickman Tower. More at meetthebuildings.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, makers of ThinkPad and new IdeaPad notebook PCs, dedicating 1% of income, supporting entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here. It's Wednesday, the 10th of September. It's not quite a silk purse out of a sow's ear, but Lehman Brothers does seem to have bought itself some time. The troubled investment bank came clean today. This morning, Lehman let us in on its losses last quarter, almost $4 billion. It shared its plans to bounce back from that loss as well. Response was generally positive, but you know what they say about those best-laid plans. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
Lehman Brothers plans to separate the good from the bad and the ugly. The brokerage giant will sell a big chunk of its still valuable investment management division, and those nasty commercial real estate assets, Lehman will unload those into an entirely separate public company. That company will be owned by Lehman shareholders, which means Lehman doesn't have to try to sell those toxic assets, and it doesn't have to keep them on its books. Mark Zandi is chief economist with MoodysEconomy.com. He says it's a solid plan.
Well, I think the ideal is to stabilize their financial situation, restore confidence among their own investors and counterparties. Seems as if this is the best response given the cards they've been dealt.
Zandi says it's unclear whether Lehman will be able to remain independent, but even if the plan doesn't work, he says it will put off a takeover, at least for a while. That would give Lehman stock a chance to recover, so shareholders and employees get a better deal. But economist Christopher Thornburg says the plan is no shoo-in, because even Lehman's best assets aren't likely to fetch top dollar.
Lehman, of course, needs a good return on these assets in order to survive. However, the sharks are smelling blood in the water. They're not going to be looking to pay a good price. They're going to be looking to pay a fire sale price.
Thornburg predicts Lehman will get bought up the way J.P. Morgan bought up Bear Stearns, with a little help from Uncle Sam.
They'll need another white knight. Who's going to be the white knight? Who's left?
Thornburg says Goldman Sachs is the most likely buyer, but he says a big bank like Wells Fargo could also pull it off. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
You know who else could pull it off? Warren Buffett. That's who. The guy's worth $60 billion, after all. Of course, he's not going to, in part because he's not really a bank guy. His company, Berkshire Hathaway, has huge insurance holdings instead. For those who look to Buffett to figure out the way the economic winds are blowing, we offer this news today. One of those insurance subsidiaries says it's going to stop covering bank deposits over $100,000. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains why.
The FDIC doesn't insure bank deposits over $100,000, so banks have long lured in wealthy customers with excess deposit insurance. If your bank fails, you don't lose your money. The banks bought the insurance from companies like Kansas Bankers Surety, or KBS, a subsidiary of Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. Banking consultant Bert Ely says KBS and Buffett may have gotten spooked by rising bank failures.
You know, it's a fine business when you don't have many failures, but when failures go up, then you do have issues.
As in, you have to pay up. Neither Buffett nor KBS would grant us an interview, but the Wall Street Journal says Buffett himself ordered KBS to stop selling excess deposit insurance. KBS's official explanation? It can't get reinsurance. That's insurance for insurers. But Ely says that's kind of weird.
Berkshire Hathaway owns a major reinsurance company.
The big question now is, will other insurers follow Buffett's lead? Economist James Barth at the Milken Institute says some companies are reevaluating, but others see opportunity.
New insurance companies enter the business thinking now premiums are going to have to go up.
Rodney Sargent will boldly go where Buffett will go no more. Sargent is CEO of BankInsure.
If a competitor leaves the marketplace, I'm hopeful that I can pick up good customers as a result of that. And I think that's a win-win.
KBS has a large network of customers nationwide. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
3 or 4 days later, we still don't know what the long-term fallout from the Fed's bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is going to be. But at least one short-term indicator is pretty clear. No sooner was the takeover announced than interest rates on 30-year mortgages started falling. They dropped a half a point on Monday, have been on the decline ever since. If you locked in a rate today, you could get a 30-year for about 5.75%. And all of a sudden, it's looking a lot more attractive to buy a house or to refinance the one you already have. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
The bailout of Fannie and Freddie restored investor confidence in mortgages. That's why mortgage rates have fallen so fast. Mortgage banker Brian Koss is with the Mortgage Network.
Fannie and Freddie mortgages were sliding into junk status. And now what they're saying is, okay, we feel better about you. So we're taking you off the junk list and moving you back into maybe just a, you know, an A-minus kind of world, but we're still not back to A.
Lower mortgage rates make it cheaper to borrow money for a house or to refinance an existing loan. That could bring new buyers into the housing market and help others hold on to their homes. Greg McBride is a senior analyst at Bankrate. He says the combination could slow the fall in housing prices.
This is a step in the right direction, but like a baseball game in extra innings, there's no telling how long this credit crunch can go. What we've seen so far is the equivalent of getting a man on first base. That may or may not prove to be the winning run.
The housing market is still up against energy-based inflation, a weak economy, and an ongoing wave of foreclosures. And, says Brian Koss, the up to $200 billion Fannie and Freddie bailout creates a new problem.
This money that we're printing to take over Fannie and Freddie comes out of the same bucket that we have for everything else in our lives. And therefore, the potential is for longer and larger deficits.
A bigger deficit means it will cost more for the federal government to borrow money. That could eventually drive mortgage rates back up. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Boeing has 27,000 union machinists walking the picket lines. Commercial jet production has ground to a halt. The company is losing $110 million a day. So a bit of good news was probably welcome. Boeing has won a round in the $40 billion competition to build new refueling tankers for the Air Force. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
The Pentagon said today it's delaying, yet again, its request for proposals to build the new tanker. Defense Secretary Robert Gates used words like cooling off period and highly charged environment in his statement. That reflects the intense competition between Boeing and its rival, the partnership of Northrop Grumman and Europe's Airbus. Aerospace consultant Scott Hamilton has been following this saga for the last 7 years.
The tanker competition has been one screwed up mess.
Boeing first proposed replacing the aging tanker fleet in 2001. It lost the contract to Northrop and Airbus, but had that decision overturned. This latest delay gives Boeing more time to lobby a new presidential administration and land the contract.
This is less about who's building the tanker than it is about Boeing versus Airbus and American jobs versus French jobs, those dastardly Frenchmen.
Airbus and Northrop say they'll build a factory in Alabama to assemble the new plane. Hamilton says Boeing is worried that would give Airbus a toehold in the lucrative U.S. aircraft market. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
A note now from yesterday's program, and with it, apologies to the residents of New York City who don't live on the island of Manhattan. We were telling you about Target's plan to open new boutiques there, which is where we ran into trouble because there are indeed already Target stores elsewhere within the five boroughs. Down at the lower end of the borough of Manhattan today, round about the corner of Wall Street and Broad, a bounce back from yesterday's thud. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Hurricane Ike is bearing down on the Texas coast. Forecasters are saying it looks like landfall is going to be Saturday. Across on the other side of the Gulf of Mexico, the Florida Keys reopened today. Residents have been allowed back in. Visitors will be welcome once again tomorrow. The Keys had some minor flooding, but were mostly spared. Commentator Robert Reich says now would be a pretty good time to look at how we insure homeowners in disaster-prone places.
Even if you don't believe in global warming, a lot of insurance companies do. Ever since 8 costly hurricanes struck Florida and the Gulf Coast in 2004 and 2005, large national insurers have been dropping customers whose homes are located on or near coastlines and refusing to offer new policies in these areas. It's not only flooding that has insurers worried. It's also wind damage, mudslides, and coastal erosion. We're talking billions of dollars of potential damage. Right now, there's only a patchwork of state insurance funds that may not be up to the task, coupled with federal flood insurance that already went $17 billion into the hole after Katrina. And if you do believe in global warming, and just about every expert does, hurricanes are going to get even more violent and the oceans will rise even faster over the next decade or two, even if we figure out some way to control climate change over the longer term. To make matters worse, developers are planning even more homes and commercial properties in vulnerable areas. 77 million baby boomers will be retiring over the next 15 to 20 years, and many want to go to coastal areas where the weather is milder and the beach is beautiful. Florida, the Carolinas, coastal Virginia, Cape Cod. So who's going to insure against all the likely damage? There's mounting pressure on Washington to come to the rescue with federally subsidized insurance, which means that once again, the rest of us taxpayers will be left holding the bag when disaster strikes. Here's a better idea. Get private insurers back into the business of insuring homeowners against flooding, wind damage, and erosion. Do this by having the federal government offer these companies reinsurance against catastrophic loss, essentially backing them up in much the same way it does for possible losses associated with terrorism. But there's no reason to extend this backup to future development in vulnerable coastal areas. We now know too much about global warming to encourage this. Sorry, boomers. You'll have to retire to safer ground.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Supercapitalism. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Online is best. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Money can't really buy you love. We've all heard that. It can't buy you happiness either. We've heard that too. But if you have enough of it, there's a whole lot you can buy, including a chance to change people's minds. This is a story about branding, about a software millionaire in Denver using his money to try to influence public perception. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
This is the headquarters of a Denver nonprofit called the Latina Initiative, and organizers are training volunteers for a voter registration drive.
So the first question, are you a citizen of the United States?
Across town at the Denver Center for the Performing Arts, artistic director Kent Thompson is planning a season of theatrical productions.
We're kind of the flagship professional theater of the Rocky Mountain region that produces large-scale productions.
And about 70 miles to the south, Rosemary Harris sits in her office at the Colorado Springs chapter of the NAACP.
We adopt schools. We will give complete backpacks of supplies to every student in the fifth grade class this fall.
These organizations all have something in common. They get money from the same funder.
My name is Mary Lou Makepeace, Executive Director of the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Colorado.
Mary Lou Makepeace is the former mayor of Colorado Springs. Now she's helping software mogul Tim Gill, who's gay, give his money away. He founded the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Colorado 12 years ago, and it's already given away $20 million. But it has a novel approach. It funds only non-gay nonprofits.
They have to be a 501c3. They have to provide services in the state of Colorado. And they have to include sexual orientation and gender expression in their personnel policies.
They also have to prominently display the name of their funder, the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Colorado. Here's David Zupancic back at the Performing Arts Center.
Those logos go on everything from the envelope that people get when they walk up to the counter and buy tickets to a banner in the lobby to television advertising.
I even heard the name on the radio.
Colorado Public Radio is supported by the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Colorado.
committed to.
Now, huge swaths of Colorado would never be described as gay-friendly. Colorado Springs, for instance, is home to several big Christian conservative organizations that openly condemn gays and lesbians. In 1992, Colorado voters passed an amendment preventing the state from specifically protecting gays from discrimination. Tim Gill responded by starting two philanthropies, one to fund gay causes, the other, the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Colorado, to gain acceptance for gays among the non-gay community.
People have sometimes been scared of gay. And so by putting it there in all these completely safe places, we kind of make the word innocuous.
You know, in the corporate world, you can buy advertising to change your image. In the philanthropy world, that's not recognized so well, so you can do it through recognition for the grants that you make.
Eileen Heisman runs the National Philanthropic Trust. She says Gill's idea of using philanthropy to change social attitudes is similar to the way corporations with a negative image sponsor Little League to gain favor.
Money can't buy you love, but it can certainly buy you lots of friends.
The grants Tim Gill's organizations make are relatively small. They average less than $10,000, but the fund makes 200 of them a year. At what point do you feel that your mission has been accomplished?
You know, if at some point gays and lesbians achieve substantial equality in society, then maybe I can start funding nuclear physics research or something, and that would probably be fun too. But for right now, that's where it's going.
In Denver, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Coming up, what's a mafia shakedown like?
They began by pickpocketing and damaging the cars of clients. Then they cut out electricity, our gas, the water. I didn't know who was doing this and began to get very worried, extremely anxious.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added a third of 1% today, 38 points to close at 11,268. The NASDAQ nudged up 0.8%, 18 points, finished at 22.28. The S&P 500 gained 0.6%, 7 points, ended things at 12.32. The folks who manage the S&P dropped Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac from the index today. In their place, Salesforce.com, that's a software company, and Fastenal, which makes nuts and bolts. Salesforce jumped more than 7% on that news. Fastenal gained just 0.75%. Investors decided energy stocks look cheap. They snapped up everything from refiners to mining companies today. Exxon spouted 2.75%. Chevron pumped up 3%. ConocoPhillips sparked up more than 5% today. Freeport-McMoRan dug up a 6% gain. Alcoa struck up 1% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.63%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for July. The Treasury Department releases the federal budget for August. And a House committee examines the role of museums and libraries in strengthening communities. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Whether you buy your clothes at Ross or on Rodeo Drive, what's happening in New York City is going to help decide what you're wearing next spring. This is Fashion Week. That's with a capital F and a capital W. It is the chance for designers to strut their stuff and hope it sells, which is no sure thing in a troubled economy. We've called Kate Betts from Time, Style, and Design to get her take on the business of fashion this year. And Kate, I guess that's got to be the first question, right? How is business?
It's tough times. I mean, the economy is very difficult, especially for American buyers, both the consumer on the street and the department store buyers, who are the people who are taking in the fashion shows this week. And I think people, from the people I've spoken to, they are very cautious and discerning.
You say discerning in a certain way.
Well, I say discerning because, you know, a lot of the shows we're seeing here at Bryant Park are high-end fashion shows from designers like Michael Kors and Ralph Lauren and Marc Jacobs. And these are clothes and accessories that run in the thousands of dollars. So I don't think that their customer has gone away per se. People who can afford to spend that kind of money maybe still have that kind of money, but they are not spending it as freely as they would have a year or two ago.
What about closer to the mere mortal end of the market?
The mere mortal end of the market, you know, is doing pretty well. If you walk up and down Fifth Avenue and look at stores like Abercrombie & Fitch and The Gap, you see hordes of Europeans armed with strong euros going in and coming out with huge shopping bags over stuff. But those kind of mass market brands, they can't really survive if the high end doesn't survive, because the high end is what feeds them creatively. You know, it is a food chain in fashion. I mean, the great ideas come down the runway and everybody's watching for them, and then they will infiltrate the market. They'll be knocked off. So you need the high end to succeed in order for the low end to also succeed.
What about some of the lesser known up and coming designers? How tough is it for them to get their lines out in this economy?
I was at a show yesterday of a young designer named Sophie Taillet, who's French, who shows here, and she, you know, had to get friends to help her out and people to do favors for her, makeup artists to work for free, models to work for free. I mean, she invested, I think, you know, all of her personal savings, everything in one shot.
That's a crazy amount of hope for something as ephemeral as the fashion business.
Yeah, I think that's probably why you don't see a lot of people investing in fashion. I mean, we've seen private equity invest in fashion in the last few years. This has been, you know, when the economy was booming, fashion suddenly became something that was kind of fun and people had enough money to say, hey, let's give it a shot. But even some of the private equity people who have been investing in fashion businesses, like Change Capital Partners bought Jill Sander a few years ago, and now they've already flipped it and sold it to Onward Holdings. So, you know, even they're getting out of the business while they can.
While I have you, I have to ask you the hemlines question in relation to the stock market. Hemlines go up, stock market goes up, hemlines go down, it goes down. So where are we going?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm sorry to say I don't have the answer. But
oh, come on.
There could have been a little argument for hemlines going down this summer when you saw people wearing, you know, very long, sort of flowing, flowery dresses to the ankle. But I don't think that's a trend that we're going to see going forward.
So they're just kind of there, right?
They're kind of at the knee, a little bit below the knee. You know, it's very iffy. Kind of like the stock
Funnily
market.
Funnily enough, so is the stock market. Exactly, that's right. Kate Betts is the editor of Time, Style, and Design. It is on newsstands now. Kate Betts, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You know, economic times are tough when even the bad guys are feeling the squeeze. In southern Italy, more than three quarters of all small businesses pay protection money to the mob. A movement to just say no has been gaining ground, mostly because business owners just can't afford to pay up anymore. There were street protests this week against the mafia, and for the first time, a restaurant owner has reported the extortion to the police. He's named names, too, and now he's waiting for others to do the same, as Megan Williams reports from Palermo.
In some ways, Vincenzo Conticello is a typical Sicilian. proud, gregarious, and welcoming.
Bevete qualcosa, una birra, un vino, un'acqua.
But when it comes to resisting extortion from the mafia, he's one of a kind. Conticello tells how 2 years ago the mafia laid the groundwork for extorting pizzo, or protection money, from his thriving historic restaurant in downtown Palermo.
Ci rompevano le automobili dei clienti.
They began by pickpocketing and damaging the cars of clients. Then they cut out electricity, our gas, the water. I didn't know who was doing this and began to get very worried, extremely anxious.
Then he got a visit.
Poi entra un mafioso là nella focacceria.
The police arrested the gangster, and later, despite threats and more damage to his restaurant, Conticello fingered him and three others in court. They're now doing up to 16 years in prison. That's cost Conticello his mafia clientele, but his local hero status has made up for it. His restaurant is thriving. His life, on the other hand, will never be the same. He's under 24-hour protection, and he worries constantly about his family. But Conticello doesn't feel alone. That's because Italy's most powerful business association, Confindustria, recently announced it will ban any business from its group that is found paying protection money to the mob. Dino Paternostro is a longtime anti-mafia activist from nearby Corleone, the name made famous by the Godfather movies. He's pleased with the move, but he also says business groups need to keep pushing the issue, not just when it suits them.
It's an important stance, but I think it's also influenced by the economic crisis right now. Businesses can no longer afford to pay the mafia, and groups like Confindustria are responding to that.
Italy's economy is the worst in Europe, and southern regions like Sicily are sliding into poverty. Back at his restaurant, Conticello says despite Confindustria's new anti-mafia stance, support from other Palermo shop and restaurant owners has been scant. He says instead of applauding his move, they resent that he's now off the hook from paying the mafia while they're not.
Here in the neighborhood, none of the other shopkeepers came by. Nobody, absolutely nobody.
While the ever-present police guards are a reminder of the high price Conticello is paying for having denounced organized crime, until other Palermo businesses start naming names, they'll keep on paying too, the mob. In Palermo, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final thought today as Congress gets set to take up the question of offshore drilling for oil. The Minerals Management Service is the federal agency that oversees drilling on federal property, what there is of it now and what might come in the future. And that makes a series of reports out today from the Interior Department's Inspector General all the more relevant. The IG says government employees share drugs and sex with workers at the oil companies they regulate. In fact, he called it a culture of substance abuse and promiscuity. The MMS runs the government's oil royalty program, too. That's where oil companies pay for the right to drill, about $10 billion a year. Although the program has been criticized for not collecting enough of a cut from $103 a barrel crude. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 38 points, a third percent. The NASDAQ added 18 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 bumped up 7 points. That is 0.6% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, shipping companies get picky about their ports.
And many of these companies truly are global, and they've got options. They don't need to just serve the U.S. market. They've got business that has nothing to do with the United States.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.